Nations by the President, the Commander-in-Chief, secretly contradicted this JCS guidance in the war plans, as did further subdelegation by SINCPAC. It wasn't only one nor half a dozen four-star admirals and generals who felt authorized to initiate nuclear operations in some realistic circumstances, but their far-flung three-star subordinates as well. And who knew how many others? I still didn't feel certain that the alleged letters from President Eisenhower actually existed. No one had offered to show them to me, or even claimed to have seen one himself. Yet the affirmation from the 7th Fleet Nuclear Control Officer that SINCPAC had on his own authority made such a delegation to the 7th Fleet Commander, and perhaps others, meant to me that the belief that Eisenhower had himself formally given such authorization to SINCPAC had consequences, whether or not that belief was true. It was clear from both nuclear control officers' manner in speaking about this that they were telling me something of the highest sensitivity. I refrained from asking whether they were aware of even further delegations to officers still lower in the chain of command. In light of the broadly and firmly held understanding within the military, not only the public, explicitly confirmed in secret war plans, that authority to initiate nuclear war rested exclusively with the President, such delegations would have looked questionable or even gravely illegal to the recipients if they had not shared a secret belief that the President himself had chosen to make such a delegation to theater commanders. But given that belief, and I found it widely held in the Pacific, it was clear that the same incentives that influenced the President existed for further delegations by lower commanders. Each level of command had reason to worry that during a crisis, an outage of communications, whether due to atmospheric or technical difficulties or an enemy attack on that command headquarters, could paralyze the nuclear capabilities of subordinate units unless they'd been delegated authority to act under such conditions, as the commanders apparently all believed SINCPAC had been by the President. Indeed, SINCPAC would logically infer that he could not reliably carry out the intention of the President with respect to the actions of his theater nuclear capability in the event that Washington was attacked or out of communication, unless he provided explicitly for the possibility, actually the likelihood, that he himself would also be attacked, or might be out of communications for other quite ordinary reasons, with his subordinate commands. He could provide for that only in the same way that President Eisenhower had, namely by allowing lower commanders to exercise their own judgment in those circumstances. In any case, the two admirals found this sub-delegation totally compatible, even obligatory in terms of naval traditions. But in this situation, the logic that applied to the Navy and to SINCPAC applied as well to all other unified and specified commanders to whom the President had allegedly delegated authority. These were the theater commanders in Europe, Alaska, the Mediterranean, and Atlantic, and Strategic Air Command, as well as NORAD, the Air Defense Command. Unless the President forbade such further delegation explicitly, and perhaps even if he did, the example of his own delegation to SINCPAC and other theater commanders seemed likely to be imitated, not only in the Pacific but also in other theaters around the world. And it was implicit in what these officers told me that the President had not explicitly forbidden these theater commanders to delegate that authority any further in the manner that SINCPAC had sub-delegated to the 7th Fleet. Nevertheless, I found it hard to believe that the President would have wanted any further delegations, or that he even knew they existed. His own action of delegation, assuming these letters really existed, distributed the authority to just over half a dozen four-star generals and admirals. Further delegations multiplied the number of individuals with authority, under some conditions, to initiate nuclear war, and also drew into that circle officers of progressively lower rank, lesser experience and maturity, and narrower responsibilities and access to information. At some point, as one moved down the chain of command, the advantages of providing further assurance of a retaliatory response would be outweighed, it appeared to me, by the increased risks of a wrong response. Not only were the risks progressively greater as lower units and levels of command became involved, but from the President's perspective, the need or incentive for subsequent delegations was progressively smaller, involving smaller portions of the overall retaliatory forces. But to a commander at the lower level, whose mission understandably seemed to him to have transcendent importance if it involved any nuclear weapons at all, it wouldn't look that way. He would want to be sure that his weapons took part in the big war, the fight for national survival and victory. If you left the decision whether to delegate further to each successive layer of command, I suspected it would likely go down to the bottom. In the limit, every flight commander, if not every pilot with a weapon aboard, would feel authorized under some circumstances to initiate nuclear war with the communist bloc. He might even be authorized, orally or in writing, by an immediate superior, with or without the knowledge of higher levels of command. I accepted as inescapable the idea of Eisenhower's delegation of authority to execute war plans to a handful of four-star admirals and generals outside Washington. But I had growing unease, to put it mildly, at the prospect that this delegation reverberated downward in a widening circle that permitted authorized launch by more and more subordinate commanders, not to mention the physical possibility of unauthorized action by control officers or by crews of alert nuclear vehicles, whether planes or submarines. That was already in my mind when I decided to take the trip to Kunshan described earlier. Disturbing as I found that base commander's expressed readiness for conscientious insubordination, it seemed more in sync with the looseness of nuclear control in the Pacific than I would have thought possible, had I not learned of the widespread practice of delegation. Moreover, it occurred to me that arrangements made to allow an authorized initiation of nuclear attacks under emergency conditions at a given level of command below Washington could be exploited to permit an unauthorized initiative at that same level, either by an aberrant commander or perhaps by one of his subordinates in the absence of a real emergency. A few years later, that was the basic plot element in the film Dr. Strangelove. But what now seemed more likely was that one or another sane and conscientiously loyal commander might have reason to believe that he was authorized to start a nuclear war under not uncommon circumstances, possibly on the basis of ambiguous or false tactical warning during a failure of communications with higher command. Moreover, indications of a possible imminent attack on his own forces would put great pressure on such a commander to take steps to protect them from destruction, as well as to preempt the enemy attack and limit damage to other U.S. forces and the population. I felt that this sub-delegation was a situation that the president should know about. I suspected strongly that he didn't. I couldn't believe that he would have wanted or allowed authority to start World War III to be as widespread as it appeared to be. If so, then once informed, he might want to reconsider the initial delegation to theater commanders. Or more likely, since that seemed incompatible with the deterrence of a decapitating strike, he could take special pains to keep them from extending the authority to initiate nuclear war far down the command chain, and truly enforce measures to prevent unauthorized action, such as introducing permissive action links. In 1960, I didn't know what I could do about this problem. How, to whom, and through what channels I might raise it were delicate questions. It wouldn't serve anything if the main reaction to my reporting and recommendations was consternation that I knew and was conveying this sensitive information, along with an effort to track down and punish the people who had confided it to me. Since I was working for SyncPAC precisely on command and control of nuclear operations, the officers who had told me could argue that they felt I had a need to know. But it was harder for me to make that case for telling someone outside the Pacific Command unless they were above SyncPAC in the chain of command. Who in Washington had the authority to investigate and perhaps change this situation? Obviously the President. But at this point I wasn't working for anyone in the White House on these matters, nor was anyone at RAND. It was hard to contemplate getting to the President or any staff person close to him without revealing what it was that needed urgent attention. The Secretary of Defense? Same problem. Yet to reveal it to anyone who didn't know it already, that is, to almost anyone, was to open myself to subsequent charges of extreme indiscretion, a major breach of security. That could quickly knock me and RAND as well out of the chance of remedying this or any other situation. I wasn't sure how to manage it, but I was determined to find some way to bring this issue to the president's attention. Chapter 4. Iwakuni. Nuclear Weapons Off the Books. In my fieldwork for SyncPAC, I found yet another case where considerations of safety and even alliances and rights to U.S. bases abroad yielded to a command's preference for fast action. In this case, it represented a conflict with higher authority covered by secrecy and lies that amounted to insubordination and even to treaty violation. It was one more example of the surprising and alarming looseness of control of nuclear weapons in the Pacific Command. In PACOM's GEOP, a number of the bases scheduled to deliver nuclear weapons in the event of general war were located in Japan. But U.S. plans for using these bases collided with a central Japanese policy, which renounced and forbade the development, possession, and introduction of nuclear weapons in Japan. A legacy of Hiroshima was what U.S. planners called Japan's nuclear allergy. A major provision of Japan's mutual security treaty with the United States in 1960 was the explicit agreement that no nuclear weapons would be stationed in Japan. Any abrogation of this agreement could easily have cost us our major Asian ally and our most strategically important bases in the East. In practice, the United States acted as if there were one exception to this agreement. It was, I was told, known to some high officials in Japan, but it was never acknowledged publicly by either side. American warships that came into Japanese ports for R&R, rest and recuperation visits, which were very important to maintaining Navy morale in the Pacific, and thus reenlistment, virtually all had nuclear weapons aboard. This didn't apply only to the carriers, which were loaded with nuclear bombs for their planes. As Admiral Eugene LaRocque later testified, nearly every Navy ship that could carry a nuclear weapon of some kind did so, down to destroyers that had nuclear torpedoes and anti-submarine weapons. None of them ever offloaded these weapons before they came into a Japanese harbor. The Department of Defense had, and still has, a policy that they will not acknowledge the presence or absence of nuclear weapons on any particular warship or base anywhere in the world. A major purpose of this policy is to avoid having either to lie explicitly or to admit having nuclear weapons aboard these ships in Japanese ports whenever the political opposition in Japan or anti-nuclear activists raise the question, which they did regularly. When high-ranking Japanese officials were asked this question, they said, falsely, they were confident no nuclear weapons were present on these ships, since they had not been notified otherwise by the United States, nor had there been the prior consultation required by the security treaty. The United States could justify its failure to notify the Japanese otherwise on the grounds that Japanese officials didn't want to be told officially, thereby enabling them to continue giving this answer without demonstrably lying. And if the truth ever came out, the United States could say that its understanding of the agreement didn't require it to notify the Japanese of the presence of weapons that were not stationed in Japan, but were merely in transit on temporary visits. Still, the fact that these weapons would be present in Japanese ports for days to weeks at a time on a given ship, and that at any given time there was usually one or more such ships somewhere at anchor in Japanese harbors, meant that Japanese coastal cities surely constituted high-priority targets in Soviet nuclear war planning, just as if they had had nuclear weapons permanently stationed there. And since these weapons were on ships, the chance of a collision or an accident detonating the high explosives on one of these weapons, or otherwise releasing radioactive materials in the vicinity of a Japanese city, was not zero, and it was higher than it would have been if the weapons had been stored ashore. That possibility also applied to the nuclear reactors on nuclear-powered ships and submarines. Eventually, the Department of Defense hoped to be able to bring Polaris submarines into Japanese waters, with their additional risk of an accident involving a nuclear weapon, as was also true of the nuclear bombs on carriers or other ship-based weapons. A high explosive detonation could conceivably lead to a partial or full nuclear explosion. But even without that unlikely result, the dispersion of radioactive material in a populated area would be a spectacularly bad way of announcing to the Japanese public the presence of U.S. nuclear weapons in their waters. But the risk, compared with the convenience of using Japanese ports, seemed small enough to be worth taking. Apart from this arrangement, however, I was always told that we didn't violate the agreement to the extent of actually basing weapons ashore in any of our U.S. Air Force bases in Japan. Planes on these bases were assigned a very sizable number of nuclear targets in the Vladivostok area and China in the event of general war, but their weapons would have had to be delivered from Okinawa or Guam. There were KC-97 tankers on alert in Okinawa loaded with nuclear weapons for these Japanese bases. The operation involving them was codenamed High Gear. If there was an order to execute war plans or a launch on warning, these planes would take off for Japan. In principle, we were to get the approval of the Japanese government before any weapons could be landed in Japan or launched from Japanese bases. But the alert plans called for the transport planes, once launched from Okinawa on warning, to land on bases in Japan and deliver their weapons whether or not permission had yet been granted from the Japanese. There was no provision for them to return to their bases on Okinawa with bombs aboard if the warning turned out to be a false alarm, or if the Japanese failed to grant permission during the several-hour flight to Japan. So a false warning, as well as a true one, could have resulted in U.S. nuclear bombs landing in Japan, in violation of the treaty. That was a possibility explicitly allowed in our planning, though it was kept secret from the Japanese. If that possibility had become known to the Japanese public, the effect might have been almost as bad as if they had become aware that the plan had been carried out, but it seemed unlikely that the Japanese would learn of this planning. The risk was regarded as acceptable, and if a false alarm did occur, the planes would be landing at U.S. bases, so the Japanese were unlikely to become aware of a temporary violation. The sensitivity of these plans was a tribute to the fact that the treaty provision was actually taken with considerable seriousness. Everyone understood that a known violation of that provision was likely to lead to an abrogation of the security treaty, and probably to the fall of any pro-U.S. government in Japan, and its replacement by a government that might entirely change its relationship with the United States and China. Almost certainly it would lead to the loss of U.S. bases both in Japan and Okinawa. Given these stakes, there was apparently no pressure from the Air Force to have nuclear weapons stored on their bases in Japan, risking discovery by the Japanese of U.S. violation of the treaty. SAC already had nuclear forces stationed in Okinawa and Korea, so having marginally more forces in Japan didn't justify the danger of losing Japan as an ally. However, in early 1960, I was told in great secrecy by a nuclear control officer in the Pacific that one small Marine air base in Iwakuni in Japan had a secret arrangement whereby its handful of planes with general war missions would get their nuclear weapons very quickly in the event of a general war alert. In contrast to all the other planes on Japanese bases, the Marines at Iwakuni would have nuclear weapons within minutes instead of hours. Because of the special relation of the Marines to the Navy, there was a flat-bottomed ship for landing tanks on a beach, LST for Landing Ship Tank, anchored just offshore Iwakuni with nuclear weapons aboard, loaded onto amphibious tractors just for the small group of planes on this base. This LST, the USS San Joaquin County, had a cover mission as an electronics repair ship. It was permanently stationed not just inside the 3-mile limit of Japanese territorial waters, but anchored a couple of hundred yards from the beach, in the tidal waters. By any standards, it was stationed within the territory of Japan, and so were its nuclear weapons. In a nuclear emergency, the San Joaquin County would operate as it was designed to do in an amphibious landing. It would haul anchor and come straight ashore. The front of the ship would open up like a clamshell, and amphibious tractors loaded with nuclear weapons would come down a ramp into the water or directly onto the beach, then head on land straight to the airstrip where the weapons would be loaded onto the Marine planes. Thus, this handful of planes would have nuclear weapons some 6 to 10 hours in advance of the other hundreds of Air Force planes on bases in Japan. If they made use of this head start and launched their missions immediately, they would be among the first planes in the world, along with planes on Korea, to release bombs on Russian or Chinese targets. Since they were so few and their targets so peripheral, the main effect of this would be to alert communist forces worldwide of the onset of general war, if they had not launched first. But presumably, in most cases, the Marine planes would be held back to be launched with other forces, so that the effect of their having weapons sooner would be imperceptible. However, the effect of the Japanese discovering the permanent presence of these weapons would be very perceptible indeed. It might well have blown the United States out of Japan. If the Japanese government had become aware of the situation, and more particularly if the political opposition had become aware of it, the United States would have been likely to lose all its bases in Japan. There could even have been a total rupture of diplomatic relations between the countries. Japan might possibly have shifted toward the Chinese. For all these reasons, this was regarded, so I was told, as a super secret from the Japanese and was relatively little known even among U.S. Air Force and Navy planners. Yet the arrangement was apparently fairly well known at the base itself, and the LST was said to occasionally rehearse landing the tractors and bombs. What was known to the pilots, the tractor crews, and the LST crew at the base was potentially knowable to some fraction of their Japanese girlfriends in the region. In fact, the planners to whom I spoke about this, at 7th Fleet in Japan and back in Hawaii, tended to assume that communist spies must already know of the situation, and were waiting for the right time and opportunity to reveal it to biggest effect. Rand's studies of the possibilities of sabotage suggested to me what that way could be. It would be no trick for communist frogmen, Japanese or others, to swim out to that ship and plant limpet mines on its side. An explosion on what purported to be an electronics repair ship would at the least raise public questions about its nature and provoke an official investigation, which could quickly reveal its cargo of nuclear weapons. If the saboteurs were lucky and used a big enough mine, they might even detonate the high explosive on one or more of the nuclear weapons aboard, scattering radioactive material in the Iwakuni region, which happens to be not far from Hiroshima, or even conceivably cause a partial nuclear explosion. There would be no way of telling, in any of these cases, that the explosion had been caused by outsiders, as opposed to an accidental explosion of American weapons stationed aboard the ship. The actual cause of the explosion that destroyed the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor, propelling the United States into war more than 100 years ago, was controversial for 75 years. The stationing of these weapons in Japanese tidal waters, to no tangible military benefit whatever, was one of the most irresponsible actions imaginable. That's how it seemed to all the nuclear planners who were in on the secret. But they didn't know what to do about it, since they presumed it had been accepted by SINCPAC, a Navy admiral. Did any civilian authorities or military commands higher than SINCPAC know about it? These officers didn't know, and only at great risk to their own careers could they try to find out or alert higher levels bypassing the intermediate levels of command and SINCPAC. That may be why one officer told me about it in the first place, and why others told me about their concerns. As a RAND consultant, someone not permanently wired into their chain of command, I could alert higher levels or other agencies without paying the same price they would have faced, and they could justify telling me because of the general instructions that they could tell me anything for purposes of my research. Still, just as with the issue of subdelegation in the last chapter, I wasn't sure what to do with the information, since I didn't then have contacts in the Office of Secretary of Defense, the State Department, or the White House. I told high officials at RAND about it, and they in turn, I was told, passed it on to a general in Air Force plans. Richard Goldstein, a RAND vice president, brought the word back to me that Air Force officers agreed that this situation was extremely serious, but that it wasn't easy for them to do anything about it because it was a Navy matter. For many years there had been a working alliance between the Navy and the Air Force to emphasize the strategic importance of nuclear weapons, a principle that worked to the budgetary disadvantage of the Army. It would be a delicate matter, threatening this alliance, for the Air Force to raise questions about where and how the Navy was storing its nuclear weapons. For the same reasons as in the case of delegation, I had to proceed carefully. Chapter 5. The Pacific Command. From the beginning of our study group's work in Hawaii, I had urged that we needed to know the nature of the war plans that an execute order would set in motion. I was assigned this part of the study. To this end, I asked for and was granted access to the top-secret cage in the plans section of SINCPAC headquarters. This was literally a cage covered by heavy wire netting, guarded by a warrant officer and another guard who was also a librarian. Inside, the cage was the size of a small library room, with many shelves of documents and a filing system. My access was apparently unique for a civilian. I spent days, nights, and weekends in the cage, poring over current nuclear plans. I soon learned the structure of the overall U.S. nuclear war plan, up and down the chain of command. These all flowed from the SINCPAC's GEOP, which outlined the broad objectives and principles of U.S. nuclear capability in the Pacific, and was the basis for the Army, Navy, and Air Force plans, which in turn formed the basis for the plans of fleets, divisions, squadrons, carriers, and even individual pilots down various branches of the chain of command. In reading these plans, and later as I visited command centers, aircraft carriers, and airstrips throughout the Pacific, I began to notice what seemed to me a startling omission. I presumed without question that at the highest level of nuclear planning, provision was made for conflicts that involved only the Soviet Union, arising, for example, over access to West Berlin or a Soviet attack on Europe or the United States. Yet I soon discovered that in the plans of the Pacific Forces, from top to bottom, there was no provision at all for attacking only the Russian targets in their sphere. In every plan for war with the Soviet Union, Chinese targets, including every major city in China, were also struck. As I gathered from talking with SINCPAC nuclear planners, there was a strong incentive for them to assume, and they did assume, that under any circumstances in which we were fighting Russia, we would also want to annihilate its communist partners, the Chinese. Because of range limitations, almost no Russian targets lay within SINCPAC reach, except for a few in the area of Vladivostok and Siberia. Thus, if the President gave an order to attack only Soviet targets, SINCPAC forces, having destroyed Vladivostok and a few other minor targets in eastern Russia, would essentially have to sit out the war as observers, on the sidelines, as they thought of it, during the big game. That this thought was intolerable to officers in the Pacific at levels near the very highest was confirmed for our whole study group on the afternoon we made an official visit to the flagship of the 7th Fleet, the St. Paul, steaming in western Pacific waters. After landing by helicopter from a carrier, we held a meeting with Vice Admirals Kivett and Ekstrom, Commander of Naval Air in the Pacific. I have previously described their comments on the problem of delegation. However, by far the strongest reaction to any question we raised with the two admirals in our two-hour meeting came when I mentioned as a possibility a decision by the President to go to war against the Soviet Union alone, not against China. Both admirals drew back and seemed genuinely to go into shock. Admiral Kivett said, "I would hope that's out of the question." I repeated the question. "But suppose that an order did come from the JCS to execute war plans against the Soviet Union only. How would you respond to it, and how long would it take you?" There was a long silence in which it appeared that Admiral Ekstrom was almost holding back an urge to vomit. Then he said, enunciating each phrase separately, almost gasping, as if in pained incredulity, "You have to assume some modicum of rationality in higher authority, that they would not do something so insane as to go to war against one communist power while letting the other one off scot-free." Faced with such a visceral response, the elisions are in my notes, handwritten just afterwards, I chose not to pursue that line of discussion, although it was already becoming evident in intelligence available at RAND that a split between the Chinese and the Soviets had developed. It turned out to have arisen in particular out of the Russian refusal to provide nuclear weapons to the mainland Chinese during the Taiwan Strait crisis of 1958, and their subsequent withdrawal of Soviet nuclear technicians from China. I thought I was discovering a parochial bias in the Pacific Command that should be brought to the attention of planners and decision-makers at the national level. I was wrong. It was the next year that I learned, in the Pentagon, that President Eisenhower and the Joint Chiefs of Staff shared the Admiral's views entirely. They had no intention, under any circumstances, to shock Admiral Kivett with an order to spare the Chinese, even initially or provisionally, in any war with the Soviet Union. But by the time I learned that, it had long been clear to me that if the highest authorities did give such an order, if they had changed their minds in a crisis and did, after all, wish operations to exclude China at least initially, it would be virtually impossible to implement that order quickly in the Pacific. That was true for technical as well as bureaucratic reasons. SINCPAC planners were working extremely hard, around the clock each year, just to produce one single plan for nuclear war against the Sino-Soviet bloc. And they simply didn't have the ability to produce a second plan for war with the Soviet Union alone. Out of a list of tens of thousands of targets throughout the Sino-Soviet bloc that intelligence had identified as important, the Pentagon ordered lower levels to make plans to hit around 1,000 of the most valuable of these in the case of general war with the Communist bloc. The major challenge lower-level planners faced was that many of these targets were co-located. That is, two targets to be hit by two different planes were close enough that the blast from one could knock the second plane out of the air, or at a much greater distance blind its pilots. To avoid this problem, referred to as interference, the planners were doing extremely intricate calculations, mostly by hand, to devise routes into the target time so that the planes wouldn't be blown out of the air by nearby explosions. In this era, nuclear warheads were to be delivered primarily by planes. When decades later delivery systems mostly switched over to missiles, planners discovered the same problem. The blast from one missile would knock other missiles off course or destroy them. They were dealing with thousands of targets with multiple weapons on most of them, so they had plans for the planes to weave through a virtual minefield of detonations, timing it perfectly to miss an explosion on this side of the plane and then one on the other, and on and on. The key to all this was knowing exactly when each explosion was going to go off. Thus, everything had to be timed perfectly, based on how long it took for a crew to get off the ground after receiving an execute order, how long it took to get up to altitude, the cruise speed of the plane once it reached altitude, and the distance to target. Plans specified that a particular explosion would go off at time over target, or TOT. For example, 117 minutes and 32 seconds after the execute order. And then a nearby explosion would go off 2 minutes and 12 seconds later, and so forth. If everything went according to plan, no plane would be struck down by the explosion from a bomb dropped by another plane. No fratricide would occur. As I read these plans and discussed them with the planners, I quickly noticed several glaring problems with this entire endeavor. Obvious and predictable reasons why everything would not go according to plan. To begin with, I read reports from launch drills all over the Pacific, and saw that the difference in times, for different bases, was often hours between sending the execute order and the actual launches on the various bases, in a plan in which seconds mattered for planes to miss nearby explosions. The problem was not with crews on alert. They practiced getting the planes off the ground a great deal, and could do it within 10 minutes of receiving their orders. Of course, that too varied in reality, but this element of the chain was comparatively dependable. However, that was 10 minutes from receiving the order. The orders were supposed to get to the hundreds of different aircraft carriers and bases throughout the Pacific at the same time, and all the plans were based on the assumption that they would. Yet as I read the reports of command post exercises, lists of when drill orders went out and when the bases actually received these orders during the exercises, I saw that the actual time when the various bases received their orders often varied by 1, 2, or as much as 4 hours. Some bases never received the orders. There were always problems in atmospheric disturbances or in messages getting misdirected or held up in some relay point. Furthermore, the ability to meet the times in the plan depended very heavily on the wind. If the planes were all coming from the same direction, then wind would have little effect. It would either slow all the planes down or speed all of them up at the same rate. However, the planes hitting each target came from different bases. This was deliberate cross-targeting, in case one base had been destroyed. The planes often came at the target from 90 or even 180 degree differences in angle. Thus, whatever the wind was doing, it would affect the two sets of planes totally differently, slowing one down and speeding the other up. How did the planners deal with the fact that you wouldn't even know which way the wind would be blowing on the various paths to the targets at the actual time of the real execute order? There was no way to make arrangements for each possible variation in wind direction and intensity, so their way of dealing with the problem was not to allow for wind at all. They simply assumed there was no wind. This made the plans worthless for avoiding interference. I pointed these two problems out to a planner once. "Yes, I've thought of these problems before," he said. "Well, doesn't that make you question the value of making all these calculations and plans? These men are risking their lives flying out there. We've got to do what we can to save their lives." "But it doesn't seem that this plan has any chance to save any lives at all. It would save lives only if the execution followed the plan down to the second, and there's not even the remotest possibility of that happening." "Well, we're ordered to make these calculations, so that's what we do." The complexity of the calculations involved in this illusory effort meant that the planners couldn't make many alternate plans. It took them all year to produce the single yearly updated plan. And while they paid lip service to the need for flexibility, in practice they were extremely resistant to the idea of allowing for more than one plan, their plan, which included targets throughout China as well as Russia. The thought of even tinkering with their target list, let alone omitting a whole nation from it, sent shudders down planners' spines whenever I raised it. Many operations and plan centers and command posts in Okinawa, Formosa, Guam, and Tokyo, and on several carriers and command ships in the Pacific that I visited, had a large map showing nuclear targets. It was their most secret map, usually covered by a screen or curtain when people who lacked authorization, unlike me, were being briefed in the room. These maps typically did not demarcate at all between China and Russia. The Sino-Soviet bloc appeared as one giant landmass, with arrows and pins indicating the various targets. You could not tell simply by inspecting the pins whether they were in China or Russia. On some maps, local planners had pinned a piece of colored string indicating roughly the boundary between Russia and China. This meant that a high-level planner in that division, faced with orders to strike one country but not the other, could not, just by inspecting those targets, decide reliably which ones to pull. In fact, as I learned, doing so would be an extremely laborious process. The computer programs listed tail numbers, which was the way airplanes were designated, assigned to particular coordinates, but they did not list the countries along with the coordinates. Sorting out what coordinate was in which country could not be done in minutes or hours, it would take days or weeks. Furthermore, on actual runways I visited in Guam, Okinawa, and Korea, and on carriers, planes were targeted in a particular fashion on the alert runway, ready to take off on a 10-minute alert. One plane with a 1.1 megaton bomb slung under it was targeted for the Vladivostok area, while a plane next to it on the runway, which would be taking off at a few seconds interval, was targeted and briefed and rehearsed for a target in China. Thus, planes within an alert section on a given runway would be entirely scrambled in terms of their national targets. They practiced their drills, which involved complex timing between the different takeoffs, to launch in the same routine sequence. There was no routine for only the China-targeted planes to launch, or only the Russia-targeted planes. The pilots themselves generally did not know which country they were targeting. The targeting was handled by the crew of an IBM computer system, which did not identify whether the target would hit China or Russia, providing only coordinates instead. Thus, there was no way, either manually or in the computer programs, to quickly unscramble the targets and assure that, for example, only planes 7, 6, and 11, which were targeted for Russia, should take off from that alert force. All these factors combined to create a situation in which, if we were under attack, it would be simply physically impossible to retaliate against Russian or Chinese targets alone, even if the president ordered his forces to do so. High-level authorities wishing to target Russia alone could, in principle, cut out SINCPAC forces entirely, since all but a few of their bases were focused on China. But they would do that only if it occurred to them that there might be a problem. I never found anyone in Washington who had any idea that there was this kind of problem. No one, as far as I could tell, was aware of it. Few people had access to more than a couple of levels of nuclear war planning, and those who did didn't take the time to review far lower-level plans or to observe actual implementation provisions in the field. They left these tasks to lower-level commanders, who generally didn't have access to the higher-level plans. But as I was to learn, the reason they hadn't confronted this as a possible problem was not due, as I'd come to imagine, to the idiosyncrasies of the PACOM commanders or their geographic position. It had come from above. As I came to see the highest-level planning in the Pentagon, not available at PACOM and not supposed to be seen by civilian officials, the President and SINCSAC were no more inclined than the Pacific Command to contemplate a war with Russia alone that spared the Chinese. Chapter 6 The War Plan Reading the JSCAP. In the course of my work in the Pacific, I had several discussions with Dr. Ruth M. Davis, who was in charge of computer development for SINCPAC. She was one of the highest-ranking civilians working directly for the military anywhere. When I described some of the puzzles and startling characteristics of the plans I was reading, she told me, in great confidence, of a plan she said I should see if I wanted to understand the nature of U.S. nuclear war planning. It was called the JSCAP, for Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, and it was on this that SINCPAC's GEOP was based. She said that the Secretary of Defense and the President did not know of the nature or even the existence of the JSCAP, nor did any other civilian authority. That was confirmed for me by an officer in the War Plans Division of the Air Force, Lieutenant Colonel Bob Lukeman, who eventually lent me a copy to read in the Pentagon. To understand how there could be a top-level nuclear war plan of which the Secretary of Defense had no awareness, it's necessary to know something of the history of the relationship between the Secretary of Defense and the military. Prior to 1947, when the National Military Establishment, renamed in 1949 the Department of Defense, was created, combining the Departments of War, Army, and Navy with the Air Force, emerging from the Army as an independent service, there was no Secretary of Defense. The responsibilities of the Secretary of Defense gradually evolved over the next decade. Before 1958, the Secretary of Defense and his assistant secretaries in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, were seen as functioning essentially in non-operational areas such as procurement, research and development, personnel, and budget, and not as having responsibilities or command powers in direct areas of combat operations or planning. Thus, a Secretary of Defense like Charles Wilson might or might not be in on high-level crisis discussions and decisions, such as the Quemoy Crisis of 1954 and 1955. The record of this early period shows that the Secretaries of Defense were sometimes present in crucial meetings and sometimes not. It depended on their personalities and their relationship with the President. During the whole early era of the institution of this office, the JCS had a basis for saying that the Secretary and his subordinate staff had no need to know operational war plans, since he was not involved in the operational command. In 1958, however, the Reorganization Act put the Secretary of Defense directly in the chain of command, second to the President as a link to the unified and specified commanders and their subordinate commands. A unified commander was essentially a theater commander who, as in the Pacific or Europe, had elements from different services under his command. A specified commander, there was only one, the Strategic Air Command, had units from just one service. This act cut the JCS out from the chain of command. It was President Eisenhower's specific intent to do that. He had no respect for the JCS as a body, having dealt with them as Army Chief of Staff and later as the Supreme Commander in Europe. He was particularly disillusioned with their post-war performance and wanted to abolish them entirely. However, they were preserved mainly by Congress, which wrote into the Reorganization Act that, without being in the chain of command, the JCS should serve as the principal military advisors to the President. The Secretary of Defense at the time of the 1958 Act was Neil McElroy, who had been CEO at Procter & Gamble. He was said to be a very intelligent man, but he had no background in military matters, and he put in an unusually short workday because he tended to his sick wife. Thus, as I was later told by Air Staff officers, it was relatively easy for the JCS to manipulate him. They got McElroy to sign a Department of Defense directive that reinterpreted the legislated act. The chain of command is from the President as Commander-in-Chief to the Secretary of Defense, to the Unified and Specified Commanders, through the Joint Chiefs of Staff, emphasis added. This implied that the Joint Chiefs would be, in some sense, a channel for his directives. They further got him to agree, as a practical matter, to delegate all operational responsibilities to them. In effect, the Act and President Eisenhower's intentions were circumvented. Although it was still on the books, it resulted in no real change of operating responsibilities in 1958 or 1959. Secretary Thomas Gates, who succeeded McElroy under Eisenhower, had much stronger instincts to exercise control. Yet with respect to the office of the Secretary of Defense, comprising the Secretary and his staff, but also all the Deputy and Assistant Secretaries and their staffs, the JSCAP was and remained what later Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld would have called an unknown unknown. Something they didn't know about. In fact, I was to learn, the JCS had formally adopted, in writing, a set of practices designed to keep the Secretary of Defense from ever asking any questions directly about the general war plan. The first protective practice was to call the annual war plan the Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, which did not betray to a layman that it had to do with current operations, or more specifically, with current nuclear war targeting. It was usually referred to by its initials, JSCP. But the JCS had issued a directive in writing, which I read, that the words Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, or the capital letters JSCP, should never appear in correspondence between the JCS and any agency of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Any JCS staff papers to be referred to the Secretary of Defense or his office were to be retyped to eliminate any possible references to the JSCP. If there was an absolute need to refer to such plans in some oblique fashion, the directive continued, reference was to be made to capabilities planning, lowercase, which would again not suggest the existence of a specific plan or suggest that it was any kind of war plan at all. That phrase, no less than the official title, Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, was a euphemism, a cover. It was meant to obscure from the Secretary, and more important, from his Deputy and Assistant Secretaries and their civilian staffers, that there existed a single highest-level annual operational plan for the conduct of general and limited war, the authoritative guidance for all lower-level operational war plans. All this was intended to preempt the JCS nightmare, that the Secretary or a civilian working for him might see this acronym in a document, might ask what it meant, and then asked to see the plan. This could open the possibility of civilians working for the President actually reviewing the plan and demanding changes. A vague reference to issues arising in capabilities planning, which the JCS directive prescribed, gave such officials no handle to ask for a specific document, or a hint that there was an overriding piece of paper that would be worth their while to read. As a result, almost no civilian, including the Secretary of Defense, was aware that a piece of paper of the character of the JSCAP existed. That, of course, extended to its critical Annex C, the SAC War Plan, which laid out in some detail the nature of our general nuclear war operations. The JSCAP stated, "In the event of general war, Annex C would be executed." Reading that statement by itself, knowing what Annex C was, one might naturally infer that the provision virtually defined general war in operational terms. It was when the President would direct that the SAC war plan, attached, should be executed against our principal adversary, the Soviet Union. But when might he do that? Obviously, such a fateful decision would depend on circumstances and the President's judgment, and could be left unspecified. At the same time, it would have seemed natural to give some sense of the various circumstances contemplated. Obviously, the arrival or unmistakable imminence of a Soviet surprise nuclear attack on the United States or its forces would be one such circumstance. This was the scenario that Rand's strategic analysts focused on almost exclusively. Those with knowledge of NATO planning and commitments, almost any planner working in the Pentagon, would know that a massive Soviet non-nuclear attack that threatened to overwhelm NATO forces and to occupy Western Europe would be a compelling occasion for the President to launch the SAC war plan. Polls throughout the Cold War showed surprisingly that most Americans, in contrast to most citizens of Western Europe, were not aware that the United States had made such an official commitment to our NATO allies. Were there any other circumstances that justified the deployment of SAC and other tactical nuclear forces? In fact, an explicit definition of general war did appear in the JSCAP. This was perhaps the most sensitive piece of information in the entire document, and the main reason for protecting it from the eyes of civilian authority. I'll never forget the moment when, thanks to Lieutenant Colonel Bob Lukeman of the Air Staff, I was given an opportunity in a basement room of the Pentagon to read this Holy of Holies, and I finally came upon the definition. General war is defined as armed conflict with the Soviet Union. To properly understand the hair-raising import of this proposition, one had to read it in the context of two other key assertions in the JSCAP. In general war, Annex C will be executed. And, in general war, a war in which the armed forces of the USSR and of the U.S. are overtly engaged, the basic military objective of the U.S. armed forces is the defeat of the Sino-Soviet bloc. The meaning of armed conflict, in this case the key trigger to unleashing the full fury of the SAC war plan against both the Soviet bloc and China, was subject to some narrow controversy in military circles. It was generally accepted that a platoon or company-level skirmish with Russian forces in the Berlin corridors, or on the borders of East Germany, which might not represent a deliberate decision by any Soviet leader, was not to be regarded as armed conflict for the purposes of this definition in the JSCAP. But what about a brigade-level conflict, two battalions, or a division or two, as could quickly erupt in a hot Berlin crisis? That would undoubtedly meet the conditions for the definition, and what was directed to follow from it. And the definition was not confined to Europe. It implied that any conflict pitting U.S. forces against any more than several battalions of Soviet troops anywhere in the world, Iran, Korea, the Middle East, Indochina, would lead to instant U.S. strategic attacks on every city and every command center in the Soviet Union and China. It was hard to imagine that such a plan could actually be carried out. Yet according to what I had already come to discover in the Pacific, and what turned out to apply worldwide, no alternative plans existed for a war involving Soviet forces on a level beyond a division or two, except for the general war plan. And that lack was by the directive of President Eisenhower, who had decreed that there should be no plans for limited war with the Soviet Union, whether nuclear or conventional, under any circumstances, anywhere in the world. This reflected Eisenhower's military judgment that no war between any significant forces of the United States and the Soviet Union could remain limited more than momentarily. Therefore, if such a conflict were pending, the United States should immediately go to an all-out nuclear first strike rather than allow the Soviets to do so. But even if those military judgments were challenged, as they were, repeatedly, by Army Chief of Staff General Maxwell Taylor, Eisenhower believed that any alternative approach was unacceptable from a fiscal point of view. Under the influence of conservative economic advisers, he was convinced that preparation to fight even a limited number of Soviet divisions on the ground, as Taylor proposed, with or without the use of tactical nuclear weapons, would compel an increase in defense spending that would cause inflation, precipitating a depression and national bankruptcy. The budgetary battle between the services had come to be fought, oddly, over the definition of general war. All the services accepted that general war, in the nuclear era, implied all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union, in which the Strategic Air Command would play a predominant role. The Navy, with its carrier aircraft and submarines, would be second in importance, with Army operations problematic and subordinate at best. For purposes of planning, the structure of forces, deployments, and operations, and above all, from the services' point of view, determining the size and division of the budget, the vital question was when, among the wide range of possible circumstances in the world threatening to U.S. interests, such an apocalyptic response might be invoked. Army leaders like Taylor, and initially those in the Navy as well, wanted to define general war as narrowly as possible, leaving a broad range of conflict situations to be planned for, budgeted for, and addressed if they arose, without necessarily involving an attack by SAC on the Soviet Union or China. They argued with a good deal of plausibility that since such an attack involved a high risk, if not a certainty, of devastating retaliation against the United States, it should be reserved for only the most extreme exigent contingencies. One definition they proposed was that general war was an armed conflict with the USSR and the United States as the principal protagonists, with the national survival of both deemed to be at issue. Air Force intelligence countered, according to my notes, that USAF does not accept implication that there could be armed conflict between the U.S. and SU in which the national survival of both was not at issue. As early as 1956, Eisenhower sided with the Air Force on this, against Taylor, asserting that the qualifying phrase at the end should be omitted from the definition, which would simply be armed conflict with the USSR. The Army and Navy didn't give up, though they continued to be overruled. In my notes of the Army and Navy view as of October 30, 1959, general war should be defined as governmentally directed overt armed conflict between nations, with the objective of complete subjugation or destruction of the national entity of the enemy, with other forms of armed conflict, including between U.S. and Soviet forces, characterized by limitations on locale, weapons, forces, participants, or objectives. To the layperson, this might appear sensible enough. But what Eisenhower, the Air Force, and successive chairmen of the JCS detected behind these innocent-sounding definitions was a charter for the Army to go to their allies in Congress to seek capabilities for fighting even multiple Soviet divisions in a limited, non-nuclear, and non-general war. That was precisely what the budget-obsessed President Eisenhower and the Army's service rivals feared and wanted to avoid. My friend, Colonel Ernie Cragg in Air Plans, was pointing out in dueling memos with the Army as late as January 21, 1961, the day after Kennedy's inauguration, adoption of the view that limited wars between the U.S. and the USSR are possible is an invitation to attack. It also could open Pandora's box with respect to forces for limited war at the expense of general war forces. It would allow the Army and Navy to increase their requirement for forces for limited war to almost unlimited levels. The latter point, frequently echoed by Eisenhower, seemed especially compelling since, for years, both American and NATO intelligence had produced enormously inflated estimates of Soviet ground strength. For example, they ignored that a Russian division was less than half the size of an American division. Moreover, the supposed number of Soviet divisions was grotesquely overstated. Most of the oft-quoted figure of 175 Soviet divisions referred to units that existed only on paper, subject to wartime mobilization, or to units that were grossly undermanned and under-equipped, and many that consisted of nothing more than a headquarters staff. still matching even the 20 crack Soviet armored divisions deployed in East Germany, would legitimize large budgetary army requests. These, if granted, would come at the direct cost of Air Force and Navy budgets. One major reason for the JCS to keep any dispute over numbers from the attention of the Secretary of Defense was a fear that he would decide them in a way that would unfavorably influence the budget for the Air Force or for